everybody. Hopefully, against the team style, I think we're going to start on time. The room's almost full, but there's been quite a delay. And in general, we've had to delay these things by 5 minutes, but it looks like today we're going to start on time. So sorry, Doug, we're going to have to cut the football for another 5 minutes. I'm Kirsten Ailey, I'm director of the Centre for International Studies, which is hosting the event tonight. The Centre supports innovative interdisciplinary work with international dimension, so we're delighted that we're able to host this roundtable as the first in a series of dialogues on international issues. As you take any chairs that you can see to be free, there may be some chairs in the lecture room next door, and welcome to go and steal them next door, that is like that. Actually, we are recording the event, so people will know that I said that. Hopefully, we can watch that. So what I'm going to do, because we'd like this to be a dialogue, is to ask the speakers to speak for about 5 minutes to make some opening remarks, but then to open the floor for you for comments and questions, and also to ask the speakers to react to each other. It may be slightly chaotic, I hope that that's a good thing, rather than having a very formal event where everybody speaks once and gets very little chance to interact. I'd like there to be an interaction, but it's a large crowd, and so we'll just have to see how that runs. So the speakers will speak for 5 minutes each. We're all invited at Twitterers, and so we've invited people also to submit questions via Twitter. I might ask those if they look interesting. I might pretend to be asking them if I just want to interrupt and not talk to using my position as chair. But if you are tweeting or you've got questions that you would like to put in without speaking, then the hashtag is LSECICCSyria. LSECSyria ICC. So let me briefly introduce the speakers in the order that they will speak, and then I will hand over to them. Leslie Binjamuri, who is off to my right, is co-director of the Centre for the International Politics of Conflict, Rights and Justice at CERS, and associate professor in international relations at CERS. Now, Kirsten will speak next, second to my right, is a PhD researcher in the Department of International Relations at LSE and founder of the Justice in Conflict blog. Following Mark Dobb Jacobs, all the way over to my right, who's an assistant professor in international law at the Grotius Centre at Leiden University and founder of the blog Spreading the Gem. Then third to my right, Jason Ralph, professor of international relations at the University of Leeds and deputy director of the Security and Justice Research Hub there. And finally, Kevin John Heller, to my right, who's professor of criminal law at CERS and permanent member of the International Law Block for many years. We will again present it. I will just repeat for those people who come in, there will be chairs in lecture rooms next door, so if you want to get chairs, then please do. Otherwise, I hope that people might shift along if people come in with chairs so that they've got a little bit of space. So I'll wait just a minute, Leslie, for furniture removal to see if you can get people to come in and get a seat. Alright. Thank you for your patience. And let me hand over now to Leslie, who's going to mention that that's happening in the morning.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kirsten, for putting this together. I'm so honored to be asked to come and speak alongside such distinguished commentators on international justice. In the interest of our 5 minute limit, I'm going to cut everything I had to say about the background and the scene that we have knowledge. There are two questions that I would like to address. The first is, how do we understand the decision to go to the Security Council with a resolution that called for a referral of Syria to the International Criminal Court, and I am especially interested in the U.S. government on this. And secondly, how do we evaluate the outcome of the vote? Did it lay down a marker for justice? And what were the prospects for the ICC? Have the vote been successful to have a positive impact on peace in Syria? So for the first question, the decision to go to the Security Council, I would argue that the attempt to push a referral through the Security Council reflected the failure of a strategy on the part of the U.S. government. Once the resolution had been placed on the table, supporting this resolution was the least worst option, especially in light of a virtually guaranteed veto. It reflected a cheap, largely expressive tactic, a sense of despair, and was not conceived of as a new strategy either for justice or for peace in Syria. This was, I would argue, and I won't go into details, more reminiscent of Bosnia in 1993, insofar as it represented an unwillingness to commit to stronger measures, i.e. use of force, than Bosnia in 1995, when diplomacy, intervention, and justice were all in the mix. still, this was a safer strategy even than then, given the guaranteed veto, and was ultimately less successful when evaluated from the perspective solely of getting the resolution passed. Indeed, the push for a Security Council referral came in the aftermath of failed peace talks at G2. In the presence of very active justice advocates, as we know, Jeff Reese and others were funded by Qatar to undertake senior reports and have the power on the Security Council. It came in the aftermath of a public relations debacle for the United States government surrounding the use of chemical weapons, and a chemical weapons deal that, while I would argue ultimately successful, empowered Russia and Assad. Most significantly, the backdrop to the Security Council vote was the Ukraine crisis, where Russia had become a very clear pariah, so naming and chaining it at the Security Council was seen as a very good strategy. The result then was a window of opportunity that the French seized and the U.S. government decided to get on side with, not because it met with any clear criteria, that justice would do no harm, that justice was a last resort, that justice would likely be successful, or that the risks were outweighed by the benefits. This seemed to fit none of them. Rather, it was pursued as a sense of hopelessness and despair, a sentiment that Assad was a problem that could not be fixed, and increased tensions with Russia, which meant that it was now not only less risky, but possibly to the damage of the United States government and the European domestically, to only name change isolated outcomes. My second question, how should we evaluate the ICC's prospects in Syria? Could the ICC have had significant impact? Should we be regretful or relieved that the resolution failed? The bottom line is that I think we need to evaluate the question in light of Syria. As we know, there are estimates circulating of more than 160,000 people killed and counting, more than 8 million people displaced, including over 2 million refugees in the region. And the evidence, such as it is from quantitative human rights scholars, suggests that atrocities and human rights abuses are most highly correlated with ongoing war. And so my argument would be that, therefore, peace has to be the first priority. Even if the desired value is justice, we have to consider this in light of its impact on peace, especially since the prospects for actually enforcing justice during the conflict, i.e. holding trials, to virtually nil. So what are the range of possible outcomes for the impact on peace? Justice might be positive, as many out there, especially the justice people, argue, although not the guilty respect. It may be negative, or it might be neutral, as Kate Cohen from the recently argued for the peace of the monkey fish. If it is neutral or indeed positive, then I would argue that the hypocrisy associated with backing an unenforceable justice during an ongoing war is less problematic over the long run and may indeed be very positive. So what could the impact of the ICC have been? What is the logic behind seeing or evaluating a positive impact on peace? And I'm going to suggest three different mechanisms. One is the taking a side strategy of peace. Here, the argument that we're familiar with is that justice could have marginalized the problem with Assad, had there been a reservoir out for him, globally, regionally, or locally, and by doing so, paved a path for a more compliant peace-seeking partner, while also compelling Assad to stop committing atrocities. Now, very specifically, say compelling, not deterring, since we're talking about ongoing atrocities. Secondly, a different strategy that's been positive for the positive impact of peace on justice is a negotiated solution strategy. And here the argument is that justice can help to back a negotiated peace by inducing both Assad and various rebel groups to stop committing atrocities and to come to the table and negotiate a peace. It's a very different logic. Which of these strategies is plausible in Syria? I would argue that none of these strategies are plausible or are very plausible. Why? Let me suggest two reasons that are external to justice and in other words, that are central to the conflict and not to international justice itself, and two that are internal to international justice. External reasons, one, Assad has regional backers, as we all know, he's been doing well on the ground. It's difficult, therefore, to imagine, absent a very serious commitment to use force, and even then, it's difficult to imagine how international justice could marginalize him. taking aside requirements to be supported. Secondly, the rebels have resources from external powers, as you know, and no positive incentive to stop fighting. Backing a negotiated settlement generally takes credible use, threat to use force, or use of limited force. And probably also government losses on the ground. This is what we saw in Washington. Two factors inherent and internal to international justice that I think limit its potential for a positive impact. One, in limitation insofar as the capacity of the ICC to compel actors to cease atrocities depends on its ability to offer something in return for good behavior. And this is pretty much off the table. There is no obvious mechanism, at least to me, and I believe to be another through which the ICC can do this, and this being the obvious one, protection is not. Secondly, an inherent limitation of criminal justice, the autonomy of the court makes it very difficult to pursue an integrated strategy that incorporates justice. For all the talk, especially recently, of justice being political, and I agree very much with that view, it still preserves, I would argue, more distance from politics than any other instrument of state. So to conclude, let me conclude with this question. If justice is unlikely to be a positive force in driving peace, could the ICC have played a neutral role in Syria? I had no negative impact and put down a mark. I am skeptical, and let me give you two reasons. First, the chemical weapons negotiation, notwithstanding the public relations clause in the United States, has been, I would argue, largely successful. I suspect that this would have been much harder to achieve had Assad been under an arrest warrant. The carrot for Assad in that negotiation was continued Russian support and non-intervention. There is no clearly designated carrot associated with an arrest warrant. It's still under equivalent. Second, and in conclusion, ISIS, the Islamic State, whatever the names that were attached to it now, is, as we know, a game changer. The prospects both of sustaining any support for justice and of justice having a neutral or even a positive impact have diminished markedly, I would argue, in the last 2 weeks. Assad has become probably more, not less, empowered and is unlikely to respond well at all to the West. It is arguably more unlikely now than it has been for the past 2 years that the U.S. government is going to engage in a strategy of justice that isolates Assad from regional diplomacy while they're trying to manage the threat from the so-called Islamic State. And in any case, the simplicity of doing it too is a call that Assad must go see as a matter of fact.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kirsten. I just want to preface my remarks with two related points that I think are important to mention. First is that the debate on international justice in Syria is primarily, or has primarily been, with the exception, actually, of all the speakers on this panel, about how to achieve criminal accountability in a context where we think it should be achieved, or maybe shouldn't be achieved, but where we think it is a case for it to be achieved, rather than actually about Syria and what international criminal justice would mean for Syria. And I think it's quite telling that we still don't really have a sophisticated account, for example, of how an ICC type of intervention would affect the causes and dynamics of the conflict itself. And secondly, we actually have no idea essentially what Syrians actually want. We don't have any authoritative polls on the matter. We don't have any authoritative sources who are able to say what you know everyday Syrians would like to see. And so my remarks are based on the assumption, and it is an assumption, that some form or some degree of retributive justice is desirable in Syria. But I want to be quite clear about that it is an assumption. What I want to talk about is actually alternatives to a traditional UN Security Council referral of Syria to the ICC. Because I think what's happened on the debate on international criminal justice and international justice more broadly on Syria is basically a myopic approach which has said that either you need to get an ICC referral from the UN Security Council or nothing. And I think that's not been particularly helpful in delineating and for debating what other alternatives are possible. So I want to outline three and say it from the outset that none of these alternatives are perfect. They all have costs, but I think that they should be debated seriously, not just amongst us, but amongst key actors in the international community. So the first is this ticking time or conditional type of referral which basically require the UN Security Council to table a resolution which sets a specific date and a specific time period for which, at the end of it, it would actually refer the situation in Syria to the ICC. And it would be conditional on the ability of the parties, the opposing parties in Syria, to negotiate peace in good faith and to stop committing atrocities. And if they didn't at that certain period of time, whether it's 3 months or 6 months in advance, then immediately the UN Security Council would be bound to refer Syria to the ICC. The second is a referral-deferral option. So the situation in Syria would be referred to the International Criminal Court, but immediately the UN Security Council would defer any investigation or prosecution for 12 months under Article 16. And the benefit, I think, of these two approaches, and their benefits, I think, are similar, is that it would integrate the ICC foundationally within the lattice work of conflict resolution, mediation efforts, and negotiation efforts. And it would also place quite clearly the responsibility for any international justice and accountability squarely at the feet of the UN Security Council, where I think it belongs, rather than at the ICC. That being said, there's a clear cost in doing so. I think it's obvious that those two options would increasingly tether the ICC to the UN Security Council, which I think most people think is not a particularly good idea, and it would put the court at the whim of Security Council powers, which would essentially use it as a coercive tool of leverage against the parties that are fighting in Syria. So the third option is some kind of ad hoc tribunal outside of the ICC system. And this has been gaining traction recently, and I think we need to think very carefully about the pros and cons of such a tribunal, whether it's a normal ad hoc tribunal like the ICTY or whether it's a hybrid tribunal like the one in Sierra Leone. Many argue that an ICC referral from Syria, from the UN Security Council, would actually damage the reputation of the ICC itself and undermine its legitimacy, and therefore that the recently failed resolution is actually a dodged bullet for the court. And if this is true, I think it's quite clear that the only alternative we have is to think about alternatives. The primary concern seems to be with an ad hoc tribunal seems to be that it would somehow undermine the system that the ICC is built upon, and that the ICC is supposed to be the only game in town. So there's a belief, there seems to be a widespread belief that if you seek alternative options outside of the ICC, that somehow undermines the court as a permanent institution which is striving for a universal type of jurisdiction. But with regards to the ICC, I don't think there's a need for it to be the only game in town. And its legitimacy, I don't think, would be undermined by an ad hoc tribunal in Syria. And I just want to basically conclude on that point with four sub-points on why I think this is the case and why it would potentially be a good thing. First, I think, obviously, an ad hoc tribunal would allow the ICC to insulate itself from the UN Security Council's politics, which I think would be a good thing, especially if the UN Security Council referred Syria to the ICC in the same way it did Libya or Darfur, by not providing funding, by providing virtually no support, and the ICC ending up with the blame for being essentially impotent in both situations. Second, I think if the ICC did eventually get jurisdiction in Syria, there's nothing to suggest that the ICC then wouldn't be able to take on the cases that the ad hoc tribunal or the hybrid tribunal took on in the first place. Thirdly, I think that in pushing for an ad hoc tribunal, what could happen, and there's a chance that this would happen, is that Russia and China, but in particular Russia, might change tactic and suggest that actually they would prefer a referral of Syria to the ICC than an ad hoc tribunal, because at least with the ICC, and they've done this previously, they can have some influence over proceedings, over what evidence is brought to the court, and so on and so forth. Kind of influence that it wouldn't have if the U.S. and Western powers got together and created an ad hoc tribunal outside of the Security Council in particular. Lastly, if, as some are predicting, an ad hoc tribunal would be likely to fail, I actually think this would legitimize the ICC as the primary provider of international justice in the international community. Again, none of these alternatives are perfect, and neither would an ICC intervention or an ICC referral. Every option obviously privileges some parties and some conceptions of justice on how that justice should be pursued. But I think after 3 years of atrocious war and atrocity, I think we need to start thinking about alternatives rather than being mired or stuck within this idea that on this notion that perfect justice can be the enemy of any justice. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. This is Mark for the joke, the suggestion of this round table. This round table actually started from a lively argument between Mark and myself on Twitter a few weeks ago, so I'm happy that you turned out to be a live occasion.
So, now a live argument.
So in my remarks, I have some answers to the candidates, but I think that's a little bit. I'd like to address two main points. One, a very legalistic one, and two, a very non-legalistic one. Briefly, on the legality question, I think maybe to comment on the legal framework and the legal question around the legal statute. The first one is, one of the big discussions at the time was whether the Security Council was allowed or should politically include a provision which excluded the national monetary parties, like the party to the UN intervention from being prosecuted by that. That seemed by many of the countries of spirit, countries of the law, exactly. I would say that it's not, and I've never had a problem with the provision, and this could be too long to explain. But I think the law is not settled, even though I'm a very good teacher, my point of view. There is still some legal discussion here that needs to be addressed. Another one is the legality of the birds themselves. Personally, again, calling in a minority, I always believe that the refer mechanism is contrary to international law. So the states cannot give a power in a treaty to a third body to override international law on the relative respective treaties. You can't make a third state bound by a treaty just by referring to the Security Council. So I've always thought that the refer mechanism was contrary to international law. I still believe that a state and third parties should take even the Security Council situation still after the state immunity, Bashir, and I've said here as well. So again, this is another legal question which, you know, it's discussed. I think it's important for the policy discussion that there is still an open discussion in terms of the issue. The third legal point, and we're discussing Security Council referrals, and I tend to agree with my previous colleagues that that seems to avoid going to the authority. But when you hear the general discourse, you know, from Venezuela, you know, the prosecutor by the sea about this missed opportunity, etc., well, she can open the investigation. I mean, I think just if the idea is to send a message under Article 15 of the old statute, but there are nationalists, there are clearly nationalists of a number of state parties fighting a weak and violent side. It's a message. I'm not saying that the investigation would produce results that would be so solid to go to trial, but if I miss a sending message, then the OTP can very well do it. And to blame the Security Council for this failure to refer justice is kind of dodging what this OTP can do. So I think that's a bit critical because on your term, you need to do. And finally, on the legal points, there are other things involved in Syria. I mean, again, this would be too long to do the whole panel on this, but under the famous, you know, specific direction debate, heritage, there is a whole question whether the support of Western countries for the rebels, for example, who are committing crimes, could fall under, you know, aiding and abetting crimes. You have the humanitarian intervention discussion, whether, you know, if there had been a humanitarian intervention, or if there is one in the future, how does that fall within the definition of aggression? So it's not there yet. I'm just saying it's a theoretical point, but it's still interesting to note that when there is a policy discussion on humanitarian intervention, it might constitute an international crisis. So there is a discussion there. Now, putting law aside, and having insisted on law, I think there's too much law on debate, and this is a lawyer question. There's too much law at two levels. One is, I think there's too much discussion of justice in that context. And I'm not saying I'm against justice or for impunity, but I think that the timing is important, and Leslie already mentioned that. You know, I don't see what justice would have brought to peace. The discussion, I'm very irritated by the commentary of the failure of the Security Council. So it's like the countries who voted against it are promoting crime. I don't think so. That's a shortcut. it's a moral compact again. So the reason why people are dying is because people are killing them. And if you do a situation can't refer that to national energy. This is a legal instrument. I don't understand how courts suddenly became this way to stop crimes. If there was a crime going on in the streets, I know comparisons are limited, but still, if there was a crime being committed in the streets, you send a cop, not the judge. I've worked in this room for 10 years in transition justice. I still haven't understood how this shift occurred, how international tribunals became this possible tool for stopping crime rather than extra factor of human rights. Which brings me to my last point, so not just justice, law in general. You know, I have the impression that I've had arguments of political, life, in various contexts, and this is that law is blamed for things that go wrong, things that go right. And I think that it's kind of putting a blame on the ethical questions and moral questions. Take the example of Syria, we have the humanitarian intervention discussion. The UN Charter was blamed for the lack of possibility from the regime. But legality and morality is not the same thing. And that seems like a very basic thing to say, but when you read the debates on this, it seems to be forgotten. But again, the reason why people are being killed in Syria is not because the UN Charter prohibits use of force to South Security Council approval, because nobody's doing anything. Now, maybe the moral choice is to do something and it might happen to be illegal. But the debate cannot stop, and again, this is a lawyer's question, the debate cannot stop with the legal evaluation. Whereas most of the time, when most societies, there is not a discernment between morality and legality, but it can happen. And international laws happen a lot. So this is just a general view where laws can be set aside. Laws are especially smart than the legal.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kirsten. Thank you for inviting me here. I'm an international relations academic, so you can bet that law is going to be put to one side. And maybe I'm going to talk a bit about legitimacy, which you might see as a halfway hedge between politics and law. I don't know. What I do want to do is focus on the proposed resolution that was on the table in May of this year, and make some general comments of its place in the global international criminal justice regime. My take on the proposed resolution of this year is that, quite obviously, the international community failed in what you might call its responsibility to prosecute, and that for that, we quite clearly have to blame Russia and China. It's there in the print, the veto says so. We can debate the reasons why Russia and China vetoed it, their interests quite clearly, Russia's interests quite clearly, its support for Assad, its interest-based and perhaps normative-based opposition to regime change. But we could also pick up on this argument of peace versus justice, that a referral made no sense in terms of peace, and therefore the veto, you could argue, was reasonable. Now, I understand this argument that justice complicates peace, and we heard some of that from Leslie. But what I'd argue is that the Rome Statute has a method to deal with this conflict between justice, this potential conflict between justice and peace, and Marx already mentioned this. Article 16 allows the Security Council to intervene and postpone judicial proceedings if there's a threat to international peace and security. For me, justice should always be on the table in the first place. And the case to take it off the table has to be made, not the other way around. Peace is on the table, and we have to make the case to put justice on the table. It should be the other way around, that justice should be the starting point, and we have to make the case to take it off the table by arguing that peace complicates things. And that's the beauty of Article 16, I think, here, is that justice should be the starting point, and then we make the case further by arguing that peace is complicated. I guess that makes me an English school solidarist, and I hope being at LSE, you know what I mean by that. I'm not going to translate that. Okay, so I think justice should have been the starting point, and if there was a clash with the peace in Syria, with the peace efforts in Syria, then we defer it with Article 16. And I've talked to Mark about this again over Twitter, and he mentioned it tonight, the idea of a referral being justified followed by an immediate deferral under Article 16. This might sound counterintuitive, and indeed, when we had this discussion on Twitter, if you remember, I think it was the Foreign Office, UK Foreign Office, was saying, well, what is the point, this is over Twitter, what is the point of a referral followed by an immediate deferral? Well, the referral, as I said, puts justice on the table, and it makes sure that justice cannot be taken up off the table without a good excuse. You have to argue the case for peace at the Security Council. And not only that, you have to argue it every 12 years. So for me, it would have been justified doing the referral with the possible, sorry, 12 months, sorry. You have to, for me, it would be justified doing the referral given that within the Rome Statute, Article 16 provides this prudent check that could have been done in the interests of peace as well as justice. I'll throw that out there just to be a little bit provocative. Second point I want to make, I guess, is that this particular resolution, so if I'm arguing that a referral of the case, a referral of the situation would be justified, I'm arguing also that the referral through this particular resolution was not in the interest of justice. Because if you look at this particular resolution, what it does is enshrine the selective nature of justice and reinforces many of the hypocrisies that many other states in the global regime are kicking against right now. And I know Kevin's going to talk a bit about this in terms of the funding element that was included in the resolution. And Doss talked a bit about exemptions for citizens of non-party states. This was included in the resolution that was tabled back in May. So the resolution, it says, decides that nationals, current or former officials or personnel from a state outside the Syrian Arab Republic, which is not party to the ICC, shall be subject to the exclusive jurisdiction of the state, not of the ICC. So in many ways, like Sudan, like over Bosnia, non-party states, and quite clearly we know where this is coming from, the United States, are protecting their own citizens. So they're referring the situation, but they're protecting them their own back and their own personnel. And this, to me, reinforces the narrative of selective justice. And again, thanks to Mark's blog, we've seen some of the reaction against this from Argentina in particular. Argentina said it was interested in justice in Syria, but voting for this particular resolution threatened the integrity of the Rome Statute. We cannot maintain and defend the applicability of some provisions of the norm, but not its entirety, Argentina said. So voting for this particular resolution was flawed and not necessarily in the long-term interests of justice, because it is selective justice. Now, we've lived with selective justice for so long. The ICTY, the ICTR, like I said, Sudan, the resolutions referring to Sudan, had this exemption for citizens of non-party states. Bosnia, the compromise was made to give exemptions to US peacekeepers there. Why, might you say, is this different here? Well, I think what we've got now, I'd suggest we're at this turning point in the history of the International Criminal Court, which suggests that these narratives of selective justice are are having a political significance to the extent that they are prompting states that feel excluded by this process, namely the African states, to not cooperate with the court. So like I said, the Sudan, Sudanese case. In Sudan, there's a claim of selective justice, there's a claim of the ICC, the UN Security Council not listening to the concerns of African states. Likewise in Libya, these states are now picking up on this hypocrisy, if I want to strengthen it, and saying, okay, we signed up to the court because we liked it, but we're no longer going to sign up to this court because of this continuing process of selective justice. There is a political significance, in other words, to this kind of double standards that really people in, and particularly the United States, are pushing. And Mark talked about alternatives outside the ICC. The African states themselves, and they're looking at an African court with indeed impunity for heads of state. So I guess what I'm saying is that on the one hand, a referral of the situation in Syria was in the interest of justice. However, the referral of the situation through this particular resolution was not in the long-term interest, because at the heart of the resolution itself contained the double standards that in the long term are attacking the political support and the legitimacy of the ICC.
Thank you very much.
So I'm a lawyer, but I'm going to say absolutely nothing about law. My comments will be purely pragmatic, and I think it's an element of this discussion we have to have. My position is quite simple, that the failure of the referral is not only a, as Mark said, a dodged bullet for the court, but it's actually the best thing possible for the victims of serious international crimes in Syria as well. Now, I want to be clear, everybody would like to see, in an ideal world, justice in Syria, I guess perhaps everybody other than Assad. There's no question that the crimes committed in Syria are grave enough to justify the ICC being involved. And I even think in an ideal world, the referral might be part of a larger package of mechanisms designed to bring peace and justice to Syria. But, and this is what I really want to emphasize, we don't live in an ideal world, and the ICC is not an ideal court. On the contrary, the ICC is a relatively, and we could be even stronger than that, powerless institution. It's underfunded, it's understaffed, it's utterly dependent on the Security Council and states to basically help it get suspects and conduct an investigation. And it's really against that backdrop of the ICC being an essentially powerless institution that we can see why a referral would have been so devastating, not only to the court, but also to the victims in Syria. Simply put, victims want two things. They want peace, and they want accountability. And they will judge the success or lack thereof of a referral solely on the basis of whether the referral ends the conflict and brings justice to the perpetrators. Those are the only metrics that they will use to judge the referral, full stop. They won't care if it fails that the court is underfunded. They won't care that the ICC doesn't have enough investigators. They won't care that the Security Council refers the situation and then goes off to talk about other things. They won't care that other states don't pull their own weight in helping the ICC conduct an effective investigation. They will simply know that the situation was referred and the court failed to bring peace and justice to Syria. So in order to avoid disappointing the victims, and I think creating expectations and then destroying them, the court has to be able to conduct an effective investigation. It has to be able to get its hands on the key suspects, and it has to be able to prosecute the suspects that does get its hands on successfully. And quite simply, there is no reason whatsoever to think the ICC can do any of those things, much less all three. First, how will the Office of the Prosecutor investigate the Syria situation? There is, last I checked, a civil war going on. Lots of people are being killed. The Office of the Prosecutor will not be able to go into Syria and conduct investigations on the ground. It will be very much like Darfur, where they are limited to essentially interviewing refugees that flee to safety outside of Syria. And, well, I think we can see how that worked for the ICC's investigation in Darfur. Most scholars expect the genocide charges against Omar al-Bashir to collapse if, in fact, they ever get their hands on him and it ever goes to trial. And we've been sitting on arrest warrants now for almost 7 years for the lower-level members of the Darfur, of the Sudanese government. So to think that the ICC is going to be better at investigating in Syria, where there's a much hotter conflict and much greater difficulty in getting access to the country, I think is rather naive. Second, and of course this is related, how will the Office of the Prosecutor, how will the ICC actually get its hands on the perpetrators? The sad truth is that Assad is almost certainly going to win the war. The chances of the ICC ever getting a high-ranking member of the Syrian government in the dock are almost zero. At most, they may be able to turn over some mid-level rebel that this Assad government captures, and that isn't exactly what I think most of the victims are thinking about when they're talking about justice and accountability in Syria. And then third and finally, how will the ICC conduct an effective prosecution of one of these suspects if by some miracle they ever get their hands on them? Well, it's beyond the scope of these brief remarks. But we don't have a lot of cause for optimism looking at the early prosecutions of the court. The court had a hard enough time convicting Lubanga under a relatively unserious charges in the face of overwhelming evidence. Since then, it has been nothing but downhill for the court. We've seen the Kenya prosecution, again, a much easier situation to effectively investigate than in the middle of a civil war, collapse almost completely. And the chances of anyone ever being convicted in Kenya, again, are almost zero. So we can't expect the ICC to effectively investigate or prosecute anyone in Syria. Now, does that mean that justice and accountability are impossible, that they're inherently doomed to fail? Well, of course not. If we had a unified Security Council, if that unified Security Council was committed to bringing peace and justice to Syria, maybe there would be a chance. But again, that's not the world we live in. As we've heard, two of the P5, Russia and China, are unequivocally opposed to the referral. And a third, the United States, and here I completely agree with my colleague Leslie, talks a very good game but actually cares almost nothing about the victims of violence in Syria. That's the real lesson of the chemical weapons fiasco. The United States couldn't care less about the 100,000 people who were brutally murdered in that civil war before there was evidence that the Syrian government used chemical weapons. It was only when they used chemical weapons, weapons that they feared could fall into the wrong hands and be used against Americans, that the United States did anything. They are not committed to ending the civil war in Syria. They're committed to making sure that terrorists don't get their hands on weapons of mass destruction and kill Americans with them. So to think that the U.S. is somehow going to be part of a solution to Syria, I also think, is naive. And then finally, as we heard, the Security Council didn't even intend to fund the actual referral. This is, I think, one of the great scandals. And it's one of the strongest indications that the Security Council, again, as Leslie said, is just using the referral to milk some expressive value out of it. Given the material, logistical, financial limitations on the ICC, they cannot, at this point, investigate any more situations effectively, even putting aside all of the problems that I've identified. They simply don't have the resources. And the Security Council wanted to give them Syria, but said, no, we're not going to pay for it. We're not going to give you any money for it. That's going to be up to you to figure out. That's the ultimate hypocrisy of the referral. And if for no other reason, a rationale for being happy that the referral failed. Because again, all the referral was going to do was elevate the expectations of the victims and then cruelly disappoint them. So there's an old adage that it's better to try and fail than to not try at all. I don't think that adage actually applies to international criminal justice. To satisfy the victims, a referral in Syria would have to succeed. And as I said, I think the chances of a referral succeeding are almost zero. So at present, I would say it is better to not try at all.
Thank you very much, Sir, for leading us in an almost hopeless situation. Rarely have a group of panelists been quite as pessimistic. Although I think the situation is much more. I've got loads that I would ask you, I'm sure we've got loads that we'd like to say to each other, but I'm going to ask also responses, questions or comments from the audience first before I let you have a question. So would anybody like to take please put up your hand and identify yourself up there.
On the air position?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but I think if we look at Libya as a precedent, what's so interesting about Libya as a precedent and the way that the Arab League came on side with Libya was that the P3 or the Western powers traded intervention in Libya for non-intervention in Bahrain, and there is no trade-off that's feasible right now for the Arab League or the GCC to get convinced one side or the other. But the Arab League has been quite vocal for, I think, at least 2 years now about the need for accountability. But as far as I know, they did not endorse as an organization the ICC referral. But a number of its members, including Libya, was one of the 68 states which endorsed an ICC referral to Syria, the one that failed in May.
I completely agree. I think putting aside all my other skepticism about the referral, the problem was it was put on the table too late. If you want to have any possibility of a referral having any kind of deterrent effect, and I imagine all of us are very skeptical on this panel of that, but it was at a time where really Assad's fate hung in the balance, where it really was not clear that he was going to be able to survive the civil war. If you really thought he was losing, perhaps the threat of prosecution might have had some impact on his decision-making. But now, I think he looks at Darfur and says, as long as I can stay in power, they're never going to get their hands on me, and it would have no deterrent effect or no real impact on his behavior at all. So my sense, it was just a little bit kind of behind the curve in terms of where it could have been useful. Because you're right, now he's there, and he's going to be there, and we have to figure out a way to contain his violence instead of hoping for him to be there.
Let me add something to that, and then I'll have some kind of their responses, which is about timing. That the world of things that's come and hasn't worked is about timing of intervention. And in Syria, it seems to be particularly important that the West misconceived what was happening in Syria, didn't act early enough, didn't act at a time when their intervention on any level could have been useful. And it's now in a situation where it's almost impossible to imagine what could be done to make the situation better. And like Labrahini gave an interview weeks ago, saying that the peace talks, nobody really wanted peace because each side believes they can win by fighting. And if you believe you can win by fighting, you don't want to negotiate. And you don't really care about referral to the ICC. So the international community seems to be left with very, very few options. And it seems to me like there are probably no good options here, partly as a result of waiting, possibly misreading, thinking this is part of a great move towards liberalism as a part of the wave of the Arab Spring, and certainly the misunderstanding and strength of the Assad regime within Syria, because now people seem really pretty surprised that it looks like they're regaining their ground. So I wonder if you have any reflections as well as on comments that each other have made in response to the main so far on timing, on whether there were options to intervene in some way in Syria usefully, but we've now left it well too late. Let me ask you in the order that you presented to respond to the comments that you want to say.
Okay, yeah, I have several responses on this too. One is, I completely agree with the point that there was this concern about Assad and what role he's been playing. So when I say a lack of a strategy, that the vote, especially on the part of the U.S. government, reflected despair and a lack of a strategy. In other words, it's sort of, okay, we can't fix this problem. I think the vote had come to the Security Council now, or next week, the U.S. government would not have. Because now I think the calculation is completely different, the threat is seemingly different, and it's less despair than actually we need to do something, but we're not sure what. And the thought is probably at some level potentially very important to what they need to do. It's not saying it's right, but I think it's more important than it is. So I think timing is important in terms of the U.S. government position. You could argue that it's not only too
too late, but it might be too early. And this is sort of the Bosnian comparison, right? So, 93, you do get support. There's no interest in ending the war by the parties on the ground because it's sort of put the upper hand. But you get the resolution passed in the Security Council, but nothing really happens because there's no way to solve the problem. There's evidence. Nothing happens with respect to that supporting that argument. So it's not inconceivable that we're too early rather than too late to address this. And I guess this sort of, I guess the final thing I want to comment on, there's so many interesting threads, is the argument, I think in some ways the most interesting comment put out there is Jason's about hypocrisy and selective justice. And this is definitely an argument that I'm sympathetic to and that I've made, but I'm not sure it's right. Because even though it seems wrong, intuitively wrong, that you have selective justice and one-sided justice and all the rest of it, it doesn't necessarily mean that empirically that leads to less justice. It might well be that even though it's flawed, it still leads to, in the long run, depending on other strategic factors and how the conflict ends, more justice than one might otherwise have. And the argument that you make, which is that the mobilization on the part of the Kenyans and the Sudanese and et cetera against the court is because of the one-sided justice is, I think, partly right and partly wrong. I think it's right that they've mobilized that language to provoke and incite domestic sentiment against the court and regional sentiment against the court. But I think they would have been mobilizing against the court no matter what, because they didn't want to be indicted and they didn't want to be under an arrest warrant, whether or not the U.S. was free from this or not. I don't think that was really relevant to the actual strategy. It does become another mechanism for mobilizing against the court. But I'm not persuaded even though I'm sympathetic to the critique about one-time justice and necessarily reaching much justice in the long run. I think it's a really terrible question.
Yeah, just on Stephen's point, what was interesting was a paragraph in the draft referral that it seems most people missed, which was a paragraph referenced to essential contacts. And this is the UN Security Council's attempt to actually integrate a referral into thinking about conflict resolution and negotiations. And this essential contact list, or this idea of essential contacts, has been developed at the UN through guidelines on mediation. And the idea is basically that you need to retain essential contacts. Now, whether that includes Assad or not, is no one really knows, because no one knows yet how you would even determine, or how the Security Council, or whether the Security Council could determine essential contacts. But that was in there, and that's a brand new aspect that has never been in any other UN Security Council referral. I was also, just to reply quickly to Jason's point about the selectivity issue and how that then, you know, affects the African relationship with the ICC. I think some people were disappointed that the referral failed because it would have been the ICC's first situation outside of Africa. And the fact that it didn't go through then reaffirmed selectivity, and therefore that we have, you know, a propagation of the AU or Africa ICC problem. And I think this is actually not true. I think the relationship would have been further hindered had the Security Council referred the situation in Syria to the ICC, because I think the fact that it's about selective justice or targeting African states is just the veneer. I think the deep problem is actually that African states have a problem with the International Criminal Court being used as a tool by UN Security Council powers for whatever they see fit, and then allowing it to kind of, as Anthony said, be hung out to dry. So I think I would reaffirm the hierarchy of power that African states have actually been set against forever.
The political discourse which builds on this activity tremendous. I don't think the African states are that different. I mean, I saw a presentation on China's position on the ICC a few weeks ago, and it was all about discourse and sovereignty, etc. The presentation made no difference between discourse and for the people who actually support the policies based off reality. And in this case, I think, you know, even the U.S. is still part of the ICC. The African states are still opposed to the region, which someone having a victim investigation, you know, the immunity thing, you said impunity, that's important. I mean, heritage immunity is, whether we like it or not, the rule of international law. It's a reality of international law, specifically heritage. The international courts are exceptions to that. They're recognized exceptions, but they're exceptions. No domestic court can prosecute a sitting meditation in international times. I agree with those clauses. So, I mean, let's keep in perspective. What African states are saying is, again, there is a discourse on the legal reality, but from a legal point of view, it's not entirely legitimate. From a large point of view, it is, and not legal. But again, I think that's important to point out. I'm kind of need to have this discussion. I think that the funding issue, I mean, I was really shocked by the Security Council funding referred. But then, you know, the ICC state parties wrote the Rome Statute, and they asked the Security Council, putting aside the legality issue for a second, if they wanted Security Council to dictate for it. I'm not shocked by that either. I'm not shocked by the ICC, you know, taking responsibility for what it asked for. So either way, you know, I'm not particularly shocked. And just, I think, again, it's really important to reflect on international justice. I mean, I think there might be a problem to be, from the start, called it international criminal justice, we have this criminal bias in the other countries. That's not what we want to do. You know, that's not, you know, if a court is, acquittals, for example, and again, I think I can really agree with you on this, there's no room for acquittals in the discourse about it. Well, we want, you mentioned to criminalize, etc. You can do that without the ICC. Do we really want an international criminal court in the strong sense of criminal? I don't think so. I think, again, I'm shooting myself in the foot because this is my job. I mean, I practice at the court, etc. But that's not really what we want. That's not what people with policymakers want. So we want to criminalize, we want the moral dimensions, the expressive dimension. We don't want a criminal. We don't want people to go free, we don't want things to go wrong, we don't want the 10-year procedure, we don't want all this. So let's call it something else. And as the job, you know, I think that's a big question. Law saying if it's too early, too soon, I think it's irrelevant. And I'm putting it stronger here. It's absolutely irrelevant what we're currently doing. And you mentioned Syria kind of, but you know, what situation has changed due to Security Council and not necessarily? Well, what situation has actually changed? Every situation is being rebels or in the battle case of Ghanab and power, Mako was delivered to the court. If you take Uganda, there's no intervention indictment that he's coming to know of. Then I think in my view of that, it's not that the ICC has a bad effect, I think it's becoming irrelevant in the policy option. And it should, maybe it should be irrelevant. Again, it's expert factor by definition. It should take, I mean, maybe the suspicion seems a bit too far, but we should be open when we're thinking about these things to that possibility. The ICC should be out of the completely in those areas.
Thanks,
sir.
Jason.
Okay, thank you. three quick points. And Anthony's comment to kick us off when he said that we're all pretty sceptical for the role of the ICC. I'm not that sceptical here. I mean, my scepticism was that about the drafting of the resolution more than the idea of the resolution. I could envisage a case, unlike perhaps some of my colleagues here, where a proper resolution would have been welcomed. And as you said, we allow Article 16 process to negotiate the rights, the when and where, and to negotiate the proper way of reconciling peace and justice. And someone mentioned Sudan, Omar al-Bashir. I mean, in 2005, was there a chance of getting Omar al-Bashir in 2005? Well, perhaps not, but there's still an argument for the resolution. And what we've had since then is not necessarily an Article 16 deferral, but I think we have had a de facto deferral that has allowed the peace process to go forward in South Sudan. Now, I know that's very shaky for its own reasons, but the argument that a referral necessarily undermines peace, I don't think is necessarily the case, and you could look to Sudan for that. What then is the reason, what then might there be a reason for referral if there's no chance of getting them? Well,
I wonder here if there is expressive value, in your phrase, Doug, in simply putting justice on the table. The danger is of not having a referral that peace will go without justice. And there will be no justice for the victims. And that is potentially what we're looking at here. On the point about discourse and not reality, is it my argument about the African Union picking up on the hypocrisy of the international criminal justice regime as it presently stands? Is it that that's simply their discourse, not the reality? I accept that. But the way it is presented in the discourse potentially gives political legitimacy that to the reality. It potentially gives political legitimacy. It makes the political argument that the backfires are making stronger and more effective. So I think we do have to be sensitive to hypocrisy and the way the West is presenting its commitment to international criminal justice. And just one final point, that perhaps links that, and it'd be a question to Kevin. So Kevin said that the ICC has to be able to get its hands on these those that it's indicted to make the referral worthwhile. I'm not so sure, as my comment just suggested. Is there no expressive value in a referral, even if there's no chance of getting them in the short term? And think of the Omar al-Bashir situation.
You would just come very quickly. Just a very quick two figure, which is that why is it not expressive behavior and what just happened? So there was an expression by the majority of the members of the Security Council, and I have to have a solution for that. That is expressive behavior. I mean, you vote to be mentioned, but it is still very expressive behavior, very possibly much.
Yeah, but some here are arguing that there shouldn't have been a proposed resolution in the first place.
But that's separate from the question of whether it's expressive behavior.
Well, it's a greater expression if you put it on the Security Council.
Maybe not if you don't back it up. Okay, let's come back to this, because that just sounds like it could run on Kevin.
Yeah, just briefly, I agree that there's some expressive value to just the referral. But I actually want to kind of, in a modified form, defend Jason's argument about selectivity. I'm not actually concerned about selectivity at the macro level. I agree with my colleagues that Kenny was going to oppose the indictments regardless of whether the ICC had focused exclusively on Africa or had 17 investigations in the West. The point was they'd want to be indicted. But I really do think there is something very important to what Jason's saying about selectivity at the micro level. And that's the selectivity that's inherent in the referral distorts our understanding of the context of the violence in Syria. Part of the problem is Russia. Part of the problem is the financing of the rebels by France and Qatar and the United States. If you think just yesterday, Israel bombed 9 government Air Force sites in Syria in response to a rocket attack that is unequivocally launched by the rebels. They were simply using it as a pretext to launch a strike at the Syrian government. All of those third parties, all of those actors, Israel, Russia, United States, France, all of them are excluded from any ICC involvement in Syria. And to say that we can properly understand the dynamics of the conflict through some kind of judicial procedure, when we've artificially said, you guys have nothing to do with it, that, I think, is a real problem. Sure, depending on your understanding of what the Security Council
is. They don't just want to revenue.
Officially.
There are at least 3 more people that want to come in.
This topic of international justice, when you guys were giving your initial presentation, so Scott, you can be right, why aren't you using the term international law? You know, so if we agree, that the potential of the International Criminal Court is quite limited with respect to Syria. My question is there anything else in international law that can be applied to bring them to an office? Not necessarily justice, but it is not on any of these.
And my question for each of the panelists is, so what would you see as the possible effect after such a But what would you see the optimal strategy for the number of cases that have been either quite linked actually, the extent to which by talking about particular kinds of justice people in other nations, whether justice should be looked at at all, we get back to the gospel, and what it would be ruling out by pursuing particular lines. And you may want to come back to this point about whether attempting to get Security Council resolutions expressive enough. I would add to that, to come back to one of the very first points that Leslie made, the extent to which this is empty rhetoric. And one of my worries in this debate is that we're heading along a line where Western states feel that they've done something around Syria and think that, well, it's just Russia and China that stopped us, and that what we'll see in future crises is more and more rhetoric in the full knowledge that won't require any kind of commitment to action, because you can always blame someone else that's going to veto the referral, and less being done to really impact on the situation. But rather than choose an order for speakers, let me just ask you at the risk of chaos, to intervene to each other as and when you choose to have something to say, and who would like to start?
On international law and justice, or international law or criminal justice, I mean, the panel is about the ICC, so criminal justice I think is worthwhile. And of course, international law is playing a role in the Syrian conflict more broadly. Just think back to the question of whether to, in this country, about whether to back the US for airstrikes over chemical weapons. A different kind of international law there, and the use of force played a role. What I'm interested in as an international relations economic at the moment is the role that international law generally plays in international order. And I think what we have in these big questions of international order is, you know, we have a narrative of the rise of the great powers. You have China, you have Russia exercising or being more assertive, if you think about Ukraine. Is there a role of international law, generally speaking, all branches of international law, to restore a consensus around order and a progressive form of order that leads towards justice? So, does that answer your question? It's a very broad question.
Is international law about justice?
No, but my conception of a legitimate concept of international law has to have some form of justice. That's the difference between law and politics, or law and legitimacy. I would prefer a kind of law that leads to
justice. When this question about what justice we're talking about, we can ask the question in a number of ways.
Yeah.
One is the criminal versus other forms of justice, and I'm not talking about that. I think we're only too focused on criminal justice in the narrative, as opposed to amnesties or...
Yeah.
Okay. But then there is, again, there's a dissonance in the presentation with, I don't disagree with your thinking, with what you want to achieve. You're saying that there's a reality of international law, the international legal order. I think you're actually challenging the whole philosophy of international law, which might be a legitimate exercise. But you have to put it on the table. Well, because attacking one narrow corner of the iceberg, you think that it's giving you an answer. Because again, about impunity and unity, that's a reality of international law. You know, the selectivity is a reality of international law. And the ICC statute is a treaty, it's still a treaty. It's not the constitution, it's not the government. African states signed, ratified the treaty. You know, US didn't, international law allows the US to not be bound by it. And that's, I mean, we can have a political evaluation, but that's the reality of international law, which when I say you have to ignore it, because we still have to have an accurate view of it before we ignore it. Now, I'm sensing that you're too much of a removal between what you're claiming should happen in the reality of international law.
Yeah, I'm trying to stop myself from
expecting too much. Well, I mean, the reality of international law back in the 1990s was we didn't have the ICC.
I mean, you wanted to change the reality of the law in terms, I don't think it does. Not yet. We might be moving there, but we haven't changed any rule of international law.
Yeah, I guess there's always the traditional Austinian question about international law. Who's the sovereign? Who issues the commands? And I think the much more interesting question would be what we could call the Weberian, that the notion of a state is that it has a legitimate monopoly on the use of force. And we don't have that at the international level. We don't have coercive power backing up international law. And so I think for myself, the biggest change that I've had over the course of my career in terms of my view of international criminal justice is I used to think that the ICC, because it was potentially universal in general and it applied to the victors as well as the vanquished, was a really good idea. I actually don't think that anymore. I would be very happy to see the ICC disappear and the Security Council going back to creating ad hoc tribunals. And they will always be subject to the victor's justice critique. But who cares, really? If the crimes are there, selectivity is not that much of a problem. And the one thing that we can say about the pre-ICC era is international criminal law, more or less, pretty much worked. And the reason it worked was because you had victor's justice. You had it created for one loser, the Nazis, or basically the Serbs, or the Hutus. You had the Security Council unified and actually giving it some teeth. You had international forces there to arrest people and gather evidence. And whatever you think of the victor's justice critique, it actually got something done. Now we have a wonderful, normatively beautiful ICC that I see no way of ever solving its inherent structural contradictions in that it is ultimately dependent on states in the Security Council to do things that states in the Security Council would never do. So for me, I would have a little bit of selectivity with a little bit of force behind international law before I would have this kind of, you know, aesthetically beautiful system that does nothing.
Ashley's question was fabulous, as usual. But I can't answer, I find it impossible to answer it until I understand how the conflict is. So for me, it's all contingent on the next steps. If, as you heard from whoever was saying it, we would sadly tend to agree in the short term that it sounds here to stay, then I don't think that it becomes a very difficult conversation to have in any serious way, certainly at the national level. I mean, and everybody knows the range of other things that can be done. But I guess I would also come back to maybe where I'm not sure, not quite as skeptical as you have. I do think there's something about the conversation that we don't have. I'm not sure that we need the ICC in order to do that. But I'm glad that there wasn't a positive vote. I think that would have been detrimental. But I think the fact that there was a conversation and an expression of concern and that it's out there is actually, I think that it would be in a less good place, probably not to have that discussion. What that ends up meaning isn't clear, but I think that over the long run, it's good to have it there, people to capture and realize the things when you need to change it.
To Kevin's point about victor's justice, I mean, which situation other than maybe Kenya for the ICC, did the ICC not pursue justice in a way that's also, in some sense, victor's justice, but without the justice side of it, right? So, and I think this is the this is sort of the problem, I think, with the Security Council referral. I don't think that Russia is to blame. Russia's, if you, you know, I'm one of those people who pores over UN Security Council reports, statements with every state about ongoing investigations. And if you look at their comments on Libya, they are by far the most supportive of impartial justice in Libya. They want the ICC to prosecute rebel crimes and NATO crimes and so on and so forth. So I don't think they're inherently against international justice. Instead, I think what the problem is that the ICC can't do, in essence, victor's justice or try to do victor's justice because nobody really knows who the victor's going to be or who they want the victor to be in Syria. And as long as there's no consensus on which side of a conflict the ICC is intended to target, the ICC won't get involved. If we look at the history of the court, it targets the opponents or adversaries of those who refer situations to it, whether it's the Security Council in Darfur in Libya, or whether it's Uganda getting the LRA targeted, or the DRC getting its political opponents targeted, and so on and so forth. So I think that's at the core of the issue. And then I would just agree that what strategy is optimal after the cessation of violence, I think that's entirely dependent on, and research has shown that it's dependent entirely on what that cessation looks like. If it's a negotiated solution, then it'll depend on what's negotiated at the at the peace talks or whatever. If it's not, then we'll see things probably like lustration laws and one-sided blanket amnesties or whatever it may be. But it's entirely dependent on that. We just don't know.
I mean, sorry, the question might be
talked to some of you about what we should do after the cessation of violence, but isn't that an entirely defeatist attitude? And are we now giving up that you don't do anything, you let violence cease somehow? There's no political will out there. Vast numbers of civilians are being injured. It looks like they're being targeted, or at least there's reckless behavior on all sides of civilians. So those of us who are interested in justice measures, and also the people in the panel are interested in RTP, is the point now to give up? So Syria is lost, you wait for cessation of violence and then decide what to do. What are the policies that could realistically support some of the normative goals that we probably would argue for?
You don't find a judge.
But which cop do you send? Who are the cops that you send?
That's a different issue, but I think you made a very strong point, which is the international criminal law has moralized the view of conflict. Everybody is a victim of the victim. You don't take political sides anymore. In the example, which is a bit extreme, it's like saying that because the Allies bombed Dresden, that we're not taking sides in the Second World War. Nobody would at least publicly say that. But you still take sides and you do not find. So I think ICL has polluted, and human rights discourse in general, has polluted the political and policy discussion in a way that, again, I think people who are non-lawyers should move back from it. And in that sense, I think that there is a choice to make, and I think that's perfectly right. But then you take risks for making people unhappy. You're making Qatar unhappy, you're making Saudi Arabia unhappy, you're making Russia. But at some point, someone would have to make the ethical, not legal, ethical choice or political choice to back someone. And then we deal with the consequences of the winner crime. But I think that needs to be part of it. Putting justice first, the victim's interest, I think in that very narrow criminal justice sense of the word, I think is unhelpful ultimately. I mean, I saw this survey that was on an international displaced camp in Sudan. And they did this survey, I forget which NGO did it, asking people what do you want. Do you want the chair to be put in the dock? And the overwhelmingly large 76% of the year. And I always wondered if they had asked people, if you want Bashir to be cut into pieces and thrown down the well, the answer would be 90%. So we're making an assumption that victims want criminal justice, but I think a lot of people in Iraq were happy to see Saddam Hussein hanged after this very, very unfair protest, and Gaddafi being killed when showed his face after a pipe. So we're making assumptions about the morality of victims who won these prior protests. I don't think that's true. At least I've never seen good evidence of that.
Yeah, I don't think we should get into the real cancer of despair on this. I mean, this relates to Henry's point as well, which I don't think we've addressed, that are we closing out other options? By focusing on international criminal justice, I don't think we are. I think, you know, and you mentioned R2P, responsibility to protect. Just because we're not bombing doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility to protect. It's humanitarian assistance in providing that. But what I would say here is, and I think the UK government is doing this, correct me if I'm wrong, but training humanitarian or NGOs to, as they're working in the region, to document human rights abuses that might, in the future, be evidence for criminal prosecutions or some form of truth and reconciliation. I mean, we can't make assumptions about what the victims want, but can you imagine going into the camp where there are victims of the most egregious human rights abuses and saying, we don't want to hear your story? I can't imagine doing that. So I think there is a normative argument for documenting these abuses and using them either as an expressive value of common humanity, if not as a future form of justice.
And
then
there are two last questions, so
let me
take those and then come back to the panel. Also, I have two last questions.
Okay, and maybe we'll do an element of that. Can you take anything you learned from the military practice on the Garcia influence, where you have sort of national reports to see from the personal jurisdiction of the head of state? I know the commission would, in fact, have a state of mind.
Continue, I'm sure, both on Twitter and Twitter,
but if anybody would like to make any comments. Person is, anybody who doesn't know anything, he knows, we don't really know what Pinochet has changed in my context. So in terms of what's the legal basis, we have judges who are dealing with the tactical basis, it's the narrow dealing with the court convention, which is border, and international law. The reality of international law, sitting head of state still have a civil immunity. It's pretty bad about that. Former head of state, there is, you can't say totally that there is one. I think that those who claim the death of functional immunity are still not entirely right. There is a movement towards that. So I don't know what does that. It's part of the gender movement. Is it solid law for movement in digitalization? I'm not entirely sure yet. But you're right about the sequence of linking immunity to it. This is a discussion we're having, not what you do during the conflict, what you do after. And the law is actually different completely for gender immunity during conflict or anti-conflict. So I think that's an interesting link between policy and law.
So I want to come back to your point as well. But I'll start by just basically saying that I think we need to be very, very wary of freighting international criminal law with a whole variety of expectations that it is simply never going to fulfill. I have a very minimalist understanding of international criminal law, and I'm not going to own international criminal justice. I think the only thing it can possibly do is at the end of a conflict, it can remove conflict entrepreneurs from a particular situation and open a space in which reconciliation and peace is possible. I don't think it promotes peace and reconciliation. I think it is perhaps a necessary condition to remove the Taylors, the Milosevic's, the Karadzic's, the Goebbels and the Goerings and the Hesses. And so whether the ICC is the ideal vehicle to remove conflict entrepreneurs, I think it's a very open question, and I'm very skeptical. And I think if we're going to ever have a useful functioning system of international criminal law, it will either be at the international level that there is a movement to create new ad hoc courts that the international community, because it's selective, is really going to put some teeth into, or it's going to be national prosecution. I think the single most important thing that we can do, those of us who are interested in building the capacity of international criminal justice, is to promote national prosecution under universal jurisdiction. And not the kind of crazy ones, you know, the Shimon Peres's and Bush's, both of whom deserve to be prosecuted, that are simply not going to be prosecuted under universal jurisdiction, but all the other universal jurisdiction prosecutions that we don't hear about, that are actually quite effective. Many, many former perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide have been prosecuted under universal jurisdiction. That's going to be the future, I think, if there's going to be one. So, again, instead of letting our obsession with the ICC crowd out all other aspects of international criminal law, I think we should have a very modest understanding of what the ICC, at the very best, can do and put our eggs in, you know, a much different, much more national-centered basket.
Yeah, just again about the post-conflict situation and whether you could get an ad hoc tribunal. I mean, I don't want to defend Russia's position at all. I think it's just as hypocritical as any and selective as anybody else. But very few people know that Sergei Lavrov has come out and said he would approve of an ad hoc tribunal for Syria. And he came out and said that, and of course, the only site that covered that was Al Jazeera. No one has asked what it would take for Russia to support international criminal justice in Syria, what conditions would have to be imposed or put onto a potential referral or an ad hoc tribunal, what limitations, temporal or jurisdictional or otherwise, Russia would be willing to accept. I don't think those questions have ever been asked to Russia. Instead, I think what we get, and this gets back to some of the earlier comments, is just sanctimonious blame from Western states saying that they're on the right side of history and that Russia's not. And that's obviously useful in a broader geopolitical context, but it's absolutely useless when it comes to trying to get any level of justice done.
I spent more time on Twitter. Samantha Power, I think it was, said this ridiculous thing that simply, if Africa wants to know why ISIS is only focusing in Africa, they should send Russia and China. I mean, we can have many, you know, interesting debates about the hypocrisies, political that. This was just ridiculous.
I
mean,
I guess I would just conclude by saying, Kevin, what just happened? You went from being radical to saying one thing that international criminal justice can really not do, because this is what one of the movies is really spoilers and make it possible to have peace and reconciliation. So I think what you meant to say,
if it's good, I adopt it every
day. Under certain conditions, when generally the West has intervened with military force to create the conditions under which spoilers can be used, international law has been very effective at coming in strategically and helping to get those people out. Milosevic, of course, and we are doing this work, right? Even though we're on the same, it doesn't matter.
I mean, we can bother with this, but you know, that's international. And maybe I wasn't familiar with the immunity that was violated. So I'm not sure we've adapted the international law successfully taking the time.
It's in combination. But I'm sure
that's right.
Yes, it is. All right. Let me thank you very much for your patience in running over. I hope you agree. It was a fantastic house. You've joined me in thanking the speaker.